Good afternoon, everyone. It's Juno afternoon, and I'm Andy Klein, your host for this rainy Friday. But it's supposed to get a little bit better, and the weather is looking to start clearing on Sunday. So we got that to look forward to. Got a busy afternoon today. We've got UAS graduate Laura Steele talking to us about what UAS can do for you. Andy Hirsch and Josh Warren will be here to highlight Saturday's game day at the library. We'll get a preview of this week's Food Truck Friday. Also, we're going to be talking about National Ice Cream Day. And also, the Vermont Junior Cornhole Team is here. So we've got it all coming up, as well as Bird Note, Writer's Almanac, and a whole lot more coming up right after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The World Eskimo Indian Olympics are underway in Fairbanks, Alaska. The annual showcase of traditional games of strength, endurance, and skill require a high degree of athleticism. But as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, it's not all about the competition.
The events contested at the World Eskimo Indian Olympics can seem very contrived to the uninformed spectator.
It's not every day that you just jump over a stick and kick it back with your toes.
That's 19-year-old WIO competitor Autumn Ridley of Anchorage talking about the women's toe kick event she won Wednesday, a challenge WIO vice chair and announcer Sanford Strange traces to a real-life Arctic survival skill.
This game helps the athlete be light and fast and simulate jumping across ice floes.
The toe kick is one of 20 WIO competitions, which also include the gravity-defying high kick and painful ear pull. WIO competitors regularly offer one another applause, high fives, and even advice, smiling whether they succeed or fail. WIO chair Nicole Johnston links that spirit to the cooperative ethic Indigenous people traditionally relied on to survive.
For your community to be successful, you needed to make sure that everybody could do their best or be their best.
Johnston stresses that competition is just one aspect of WIO, which also includes Native arts and crafts, dancing, food, and a cultural queen pageant. I'm Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Alaska.
Indigenous youth from the United States and Taiwan are sharing their culture and learning from one another. 2 years ago, the United National Indian Tribal Youth Organization started a cultural exchange with young people from Taiwan. Last year, a Unity group traveled to the country. Unity Executive Director Mary Kim Titla talked about their visit to Native American youth gathered in Washington, D.C. this week for the Unity Conference.
They call themselves Taiwan Indian, and there's as many as 17 indigenous tribes in Taiwan. So we went there, not able to communicate them, but working through translators. But when they saw us, they immediately connected and identified with us. It was amazing to see their regalia. I saw one group, he wore something very similar to my tribe, the Apache tribe. And I took a picture with him because I said, "You look just like my cousin from back home." It was just a wonderful experience.
Titla says they face many of the same challenges as Native American young people: suicide, domestic violence, and substance abuse. Savi Dalan, an 11th grader, was among a handful of young people from Taiwan to travel to this year's Unity Conference. Savi talked about some of the positive things happening among young people in her tribe, similar to the U.S. Language revitalization. Savi says older generations tend to speak the indigenous tongue more often. Many youth speak Chinese and English.
When my parent or my grandparent said "bunun bunun," and I answer in Chinese. Yeah.
The group gave Unity a short language lesson.
I like to teach everyone a bunun greeting. Repeat after me: uninang, uninang, uninang means how are you.
They also shared other aspects of their culture, such as their Catholic faith, talked about hunting skills, and sang some songs. Singing is an important part of keeping languages alive. The group sang Amazing Grace in three languages.
Yeah.
Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by United Tribes Technical College, offering courses online for a career in medical coding and for updating your current coding certification. Registration available through August 10th online at uttc.edu.
With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Juno Afternoon, where Laura Steele and Katie Bosler joined us from UAS, talking about where UAS can take all of us, all different people. Such a great community resource UAS is, and Laura, you're recently graduated, fairly recently graduated, is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, just a couple months, yeah.
And you're maybe a really good case study for what someone who's a local kid in Juno can do, going to UAS and ends up doing all kinds of really cool stuff.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, well, how would you encapsulate your college experience?
Well, there was all kinds of things that I was able to do that I had no idea would be possible at UIS or even at other universities. So I got to do a really cool study abroad program.
Yeah, Malta.
In Malta, yeah.
What is that all about?
Yeah, right?
Malta, you know?
People would ask me, you know, where even is that?
Right.
Yeah, so it was really cool. I got to spend a year in the Mediterranean,
right,
studying all kinds of weird,
super
crazy
urban, kind of like, isn't it a highly developed?
It's densely populated. It's really densely populated,
right,
but it's also got these like pristine, gorgeous beaches and like cool little medieval settlements and stuff. Yeah.
And that was a full semester you got to do that in? Oh, full year abroad. So is that like your junior year or?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Did that change you?
Yeah.
Of course. You feel like it did?
Yeah. Sure.
What do you think you got out of it beyond just, of course, the cultural?
Well, living abroad, I think, kind of forces you out of your shell in a whole lot of ways that you'd never even think about. And so I feel a lot more capable now of things that, you know, I never thought I would be. Like, I have no problem going now to a foreign country kind of with no real plan, put my feet on the ground, and I can figure stuff out for myself. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And that exchange program is just sort of a tip of the iceberg for students and what people can do at UAS, right, Katie?
Yeah, and, you know, it's my job to talk about these things, but it never ceases really to amaze me what students can do at UAS. I mean, you can go there for 2 years here in Juneau. You could study abroad in another country and in another state through our academic exchange program. So, yes, just the tip of the iceberg as far as what Laura did, because, you know, she not only does an exchange student for a year, but she also did a study on feminism and had a community dialogue through her undergraduate research grant. She got a Bachelor of Liberal Arts with an emphasis in
Interdisciplinary Studies.
Interdisciplinary Studies. So kind of created really your own major, didn't
mm-hmm.
you, Laura?
Yeah. I was really able to do more things that I was interested in rather than a super structured, you know, someone tells you what you have to study and what classes you have to take.
Mm-hmm.
And
have you been able to kind of immediately apply it?
Yeah. I think especially with the liberal arts program, it's applicable in any career. It's applicable in your everyday life, you know, in conversation with people. There are friends of mine that did this program that are doing all kinds of really cool, glacier research, guiding, people that are like building bikes, you know, it's just all kinds of really interesting, really amazing things that are coming out that are totally unique and totally Juno, I think.
And when you were growing up here in Juno and you envisioned going to college, did you envision going away?
Yeah, I think I didn't up until I started going to UAS, I guess.
Uh-huh. And what made you kind of make that decision to go to UAS and try that?
It kind of boiled down to economics.
Mm-hmm.
My parents were willing to pay or able to pay a certain amount, and I could either go to school somewhere down south and end up graduating with student debt, or go to school, you know, here in town locally for a lot, significantly a lot cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was able to do cool internships and work my entire time. I wouldn't have been able to afford to study abroad if I'd gone anywhere else, really. And so economically, it made sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were all these other benefits that I didn't even really think about or realize until I started UNUS and kind of discovered them.
Yeah, so, you know, Laura's really a perfect example of, we had a little kind of local campaign running. You've probably heard some of the radio spots and seen some of the print ads, which is, where will UAS take you? So it's not only out the road to Auk Lake, you know, but you can study abroad, or you can really engage with some really, we have some pretty top-notch faculty who are doing some very creative things and really getting out into the community and engaging with the community. For example, Saul Neely, who has started a class that takes place at the Lemon Creek Prison, and Laura was also a part of that. What happens with that class, Laura?
Well, it's this really amazing opportunity, I think, for community involvement and engagement, because you get to kind of mix these two really important institutions that we have in our community, which are, you know, UIS as a university and Lemon Creek as a prison, and you kind of mix them up together. And so you hold class in Lemon Creek with inmates, half inmates and half students from UIS. And the amazing stuff comes out of it. It's just, I mean, I've never done a class that was like that. It was just really incredible.
And this is a writing class?
It depends on the semester. It's sort of flexible. So there, you can either take them, I think, as English credits or philosophy credits, depending on your program.
Hmm. That's interesting. And then, of course, college is about learning and about having these great experiences, but it's also about, at the end of it, maybe being able to get employed. So
Hopefully. That
sounds like something that happened with you as well.
Yeah, I was really lucky, and I think that's another benefit of being here in Juneau. I had some great connections, and I was able to get a job actually even secured before I graduated from college. So right now I'm working at the Office of Public Advocacy. It's similar to the Public Defender's Office, so doing legal work for people who can't necessarily afford it.
Yeah.
So
that's an interesting place to go with a degree that maybe wasn't specific to that, right?
Totally not
you know,
specific
yeah,
to that,
yeah,
no.
Right. But liberal arts degrees allow you to kind of have a pretty broad breadth of knowledge about things.
Yeah, and I think UAS specifically, but maybe other liberal arts leaning institutions have sort of a social justice bent or element that really has helped inform this position that I'm in right now.
Yeah. Well, Katie, any other kind of nuts and bolts stuff about UAS? I know there's a deadline approaching.
There is, yeah. And also, I just wanted to thank Laura for coming in. And I know we've also had on this program a couple of other of our Where Will UAS Take You students, Alex Botello and Hunter Brown, who have had some incredible experiences as well. And we'll get up a website with these students soon, and we'll let you guys know about that so you can find out more. But, yeah, what's happening, Andy, coming right up is the August 1st is the fall semester deadline to apply. And so I just want to let everybody know whether you want to take a class or enroll in a degree program, that's the admission application deadline for our fall semester. So if you want more information about that, you can call 796-6100 locally, or you can go to the UAS website, which is uas.alaska.edu, and if you want to get specific about the application or the admissions website, you go to /apply/admission, or just, you know, Google UAS. And believe it or not, it's coming right up here as far as the first day of school is coming right up. And
So get out there, apply for it if you're interested.
Yeah.
August 1st is the deadline for the fall semester.
Yeah.
Katie Bosler from UAS.
Yes, and first day of school is a month after that, just about September 2nd.
Okay. Thanks so much for coming in, Laura. Thanks so much for coming in as well, and congratulations on graduating from college. Big accomplishment.
Good
congratulations
stuff.
On doing it. Sounds like you had a great experience.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
All right.
Thank
coming
you,
up
Andy.
Next, we're going to hear Bird Note.
This is Bird Note.
Oh,
night, my honey lamb and I sit alone and talk and watch a hawk making lazy circles in the sky.
A red-tailed hawk soars above a roadway on broad, rounded wings, the epitome of effortless flight. Without flapping, it traces a leisurely rising circle. This is the hawk you're most likely to see in the lower 48 and the one that was making lazy circles in the sky in the musical Oklahoma. The red-tailed hawk is riding a thermal, a column of warm rising air generated near the Earth's surface by heat from the sun. As the warm air expands upward, the hawk floats skyward, periodically circling to stay within the column of air. Slots between the long feathers at the hawk's wingtips deflect drag. As the red tail reaches a desired altitude, it slides off the thermal and, gliding lower, finds another thermal to ride upward. Riding thermals is an energy-efficient way for soaring hawks to search for prey. Hawks also rely on thermals and updrafts along ridges during long migrations as they float for many miles through the sky. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann. If you know someone who might enjoy today's program, send them to our website, birdnote.org.
Andy Hirsch is here. Andy, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Juneau Public Library. And with you today is Josh Warren, because
Hi,
we're going to talk about game day at the library. We were having a dispute here right before we got on mic. Josh was sort of saying he brings all the games,
and
you were saying...
He does. We provide the space.
You got
true.
Some games you bring, too?
We
or?
Do. Okay. So the library has, 10, 15 games that we bring, but most of the games are brought by our co-sponsors for the event.
Platypus Gaming, we have probably like 500 games. They're not all going to be there, but we're going to provide a lot more variety.
Now, are these board games?
Yeah.
Physical games, right?
Yeah.
Not video, right?
Correct.
Not that realm. Yeah.
Board, dice, cards, things like that.
And there's such a huge variety. I have a couple of friends that are into sort of the games, and you like realize that, you know, my world of Parcheesian, Monopoly, and Sorry, that is just stuck in the 70s where I stopped. You know what I mean? Like, it's moved on. There's so much. Because I think that there was, such a concentration on video games, right? As all that started coming online, that maybe people forgot about these great board games.
There's some of that, and it's been really popular in Europe. And there's some like Catan that some people have heard of was one of the early European games that came over. And then once that came, it was sort of a tidal wave of more games starting to come into the U.S. market.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting. Like the games have these themes, and they, you know, you can build stuff out. There's one game that I've played that like you build a train or something like that, and I don't even know what it all is. You might know that one. Comes in a big bullet or something.
There's a lot of train.
Yeah,
games.
A lot of train games. What are some of the other sort of popular genres?
Zombies, unfortunately, are pretty popular. not my personal favorite,
okay.
But superheroes. But there's also a lot of, you know, trains and planes and farming. I was thinking that there's pretty much a game for everything, but then I was realizing there's not a radio host board game.
Oh,
so
well.
Not to get to work on
my niche market, yes. So are there sort of... do you group games by how they're like certain games or battle games or certain games or like do you have different groupings of games or how do you when someone walks in and they want to do game playing, how can they narrow down the universe of all the games that are out there to know what kind of stuff they're going to be playing?
Most of the time when we organize the games, they're going to be games that are sort of group solitaire where everyone's playing the game together but by themselves. There's war games, but there's also cooperative games that a lot of people have started like now, where everyone is working together to beat the game and not each other.
Yeah, yeah. So what kind of inspired you to get this thing going, and how often does it happen?
So we do game day at the library 3 to 4 times a year, and we do it because I really love board games, and there are a bunch of librarians who really love board games, and we said, oh, well, I bet if we really love board games and we would come to a library program on our day off, maybe other people would too. So it is next Saturday, July 25th, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Mendenhall Valley Public Library. Come anytime. You can bring games. There will be, I don't know, maybe 50, 100 games to choose from, so there will not be a short supply.
Bring friends.
Bring if you want.
Bring a group or not.
Right. One of the nice things is a lot of people show up, and they're all really into board games or peripherally into board games, and you play with people you don't know, and that's fine.
And then are there kids stuff too that they can do as well, and is that kind of segmented in, or how do you do that?
So we do have games for kids. We have games for all ages, kids, teens, adults. So our recommendation is the kids should be old enough not to put the game pieces in their mouth.
Just for sanitary purposes.
Right. So the games that the library owns are roughly ages 8 to adult.
Okay.
So if your kids are really well behaved and they're good around small pieces and crowds,
and
right. they're younger, that's fine. If not, we have other things at the library for smaller children.
Yeah, that's true, right. And you get good crowds at this?
We've been getting, I would say, the librarians have better counts, but between 20 and 30, I think.
Oh, wow.
Fill up the room.
That's great. Yeah. What are some of the more popular ones that people are really wanting to play? Is it just stuff that's new, or are there ones that are really kind of very well known?
There are some people who come to play some of the older games, but there are also some people who are already into board games, and they come to have me or someone else there teach them some of the newer games. Because I'll be there, and some other people who know how to play most of the games will be there. So you don't need to know how to play any of the games.
Just get a briefing.
I can sit down and teach you the game.
Cool. You have favorites? What are your favorites that you're playing right now?
I'm to the point where I have too many to be my favorite, and I wind up liking whatever the newest game is right now. But right now I'm liking the ones that won the Spiel des Jahres, which is Broom Service and Colt Express. So
tell me a little bit about Broom Service. What's
Broom Service is you are a witch going around delivering potions, and Colt Express has a neat 3D train, and you're train robbers trying to be the best at robbing trains.
Oh, wow. All right. Colt Express might be maybe the one I played. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong about that. You're looking at me like I doubt it.
I don't know.
Did it have
a cardboard
3D train?
That's
what I remember, train thing. Yeah.
There's probably not many other games with it.
Yeah, that's what I remember. All right, well, that's great. So it's gaming. It's happening this Saturday. It's at the library, downtown library.
Valley Library.
And it's come one, come all, and come play games, board games.
Absolutely. Saturday the 25th.
Yeah. 25th, not this Saturday. Not tomorrow, but Saturday the 25th.
Yeah.
Sorry. Next Saturday the 25th, game day at the library. Andy, Josh, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Great talking to you.
Basement and mom's to a
All right, let's talk about it. Let's talk about cornhole. Let's play it. Let's play it. We got the Vermont Junior Cornhole team here. Joe Defner, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Owen and Eamon are also here. Did
good
I get that
here.
Right? Eamon?
Yeah.
Eamon. There you go.
Thanks
all right.
For having us.
Yeah, no problem. Tell me a little bit about this. Now, you guys are, so you're from Vermont. Are you here visiting, or are you here extended time, or what's going on?
We're here for a family reunion.
Oh, okay.
And we left Vermont on June 24th, and we drove cross country and through Canada and took the ferry out of Prince Rupert.
Nice. Yeah, I did that. I took the ferry out of Prince Rupert long ago when I moved up here, back a long time ago. Did you have to get, like, the midnight ferry that came out, or?
It was, what time, boys?
4 in the afternoon
oh.
to 8. Here, I think.
Yeah, that's not bad.
30 hours.
Yeah, 30 hours. Yeah, nice. How'd you like the ferry ride?
It was fun.
A little rain?
Yeah. Some.
Yeah.
Have you guys gotten out on a boat or anything like that since then? You gone fishing or anything like that?
No, we're going on a whale watch tonight, actually.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, they're active right now. That should be fun. All right, so tell me about your love of cornhole. Let's explain the game, first of all. People don't know what cornhole is.
Well, cornhole is a beanbag toss game, and there are two boards set 27 feet apart.
That's interesting to know. I want to write that down, 27 feet. I think this is something that comes up at the picnics that we're at when we set up cornhole. You know, people are always arguing about official length apart. Okay, so 27 feet.
And so
is that hole to hole or edge to edge?
Edge to edge.
Okay, all right.
And you take turns throwing the beanbags. You have a partner on the other side, and you take turns throwing the beanbags from one board to the other board. And on the board is a hole cut close to the center. And if you get in the hole, you get 3 points. Get on the board, it's 1 point. But after each round, you subtract the lower score from the higher score, and whoever scores more points gets the difference between the two.
Oh, that's how you score it. I didn't realize that's how you scored it. What about a leaner?
No.
So it's just 1 point?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like horseshoes, right, where there's, there's that kind of stuff.
Yep.
And horseshoes, if you get a leaner, that's really good.
That counts. Yeah.
All right, so what? So you guys been playing this for a long time?
So we got a cornhole set, a couple of Christmases ago from our grandparents, and ever since we've been playing, and we played a lot with our family when we see them.
Yeah.
And so we like it. It's fun.
Yeah, it's a fun game. Now, we were talking earlier here. I play a little basketball, so when I play cornhole, I go overhand. Mm-hmm. I shoot it kind of like a basketball, you know. I want to get that high arc.
Yeah.
You're a little skeptical.
I think it's easier to throw it underhand. Like, that's how most people do it.
Okay, so I'm an outlier already. Basically, I don't know what I'm doing. That's what you're saying.
No, well, I guess if you're good at it overhand.
I didn't say that. So maybe it's kind of like maybe that the underhand, it gets it up higher as it's getting close to the hole, and so then it can drop. And when you guys, is there a strategic time? Like, are you trying to sometimes knock the other guy off the board, or are you always going for the hole, or how do you play it?
It depends. Like, if you only need one shot on the board to win the game, you don't have to go directly at the hole.
Right. So, yeah, it's all that. So tell me a little bit about how you got to where you're now. Maybe I'll turn it to you on this. Where this Vermont Junior Cornhole team, it sounds official.
It
sounds like you're not just messing around.
It's unofficial.
It's unofficial? Good.
But as,
it's all marketing.
As Eamon said, no one's challenged. The title,
no one's
challenged.
So
they're actually officially the East Central Vermont Junior Cornhole
Very
Champions.
Very good. All right.
So,
well, it's great to have you here. So this is going to be a thing where you're going to be getting people there at Marine Park tomorrow?
Yeah, it's been a fundraiser. We've been raising money for St. Jude Children's Hospital, and that was our whole. I wouldn't call it the impetus for the trip. The impetus for the trip was the family reunion here in Juneau, but we thought if we're going to do this, we might as well do something good along
Great.
The way. And so we've raised almost $6,000.
That's awesome. And so where have you stopped and done this on the trip?
Well, go ahead, boys.
Our first stop was in Batavia.
New York.
Okay.
New York. And then Eastern Ohio. and then South Bend,
Indiana, okay.
Where Notre Dame is.
Yeah.
And then Peoria, Illinois. And then after that, we went to
Davenport,
Iowa.
Wow.
And then Des Moines. And then Mitchell, South Dakota, where the Corn Palace is.
Oh, so are they like the best cornholers you've ever seen? They're naturals?
Not exactly.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, we played there, and then we drove up through the rest of South Dakota and then Wyoming, Montana. We didn't play a lot there because there weren't many places to play.
Plus the wind.
Yeah.
Hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really, yeah, you just lose a bag. Yeah.
Yeah.
So where did you get the biggest crowd? Where like a lot of people really showed up. Can you remember one place?
I'd say in Des Moines at an Iowa Cubs
baseball game. They love their corn, man. They love their corn, yeah.
There were a lot of people there.
Cool.
Yeah.
Because six of the matches were at minor league baseball park.
Oh,
and we
that's
were guests
awesome.
Of minor league baseball, and they threw out the first pitches at a couple of the games.
You didn't throw it out underhand, did you?
No.
No, all right. You threw it out overhand.
We play baseball.
So overhand's not, so you're okay when you're playing baseball to go overhand.
Yeah.
I see. Okay, all right. Well, it was great to meet you guys, and if people want to join in on this, it's happening tomorrow at 1 p.m. over at Marine Park.
Yeah, we'll be there 1 to 3, and you can make a donation to St. Jude's, and then we'll give you a T-shirt.
Awesome.
And you can play us in cornhole. And
that's a cool T-shirt. Yeah. Who designed that T-shirt and got that together for you?
So I'm also a cross-country coach, and we have a big invitational every year. And the guy who designs our shirts for the invitational graciously designed this. And then the T-shirt printer did them for $2 a shirt.
It says Vermont versus the world.
And this is for you, by the way.
Oh, that's amazing. So, I love it. I didn't want to have to ask.
So,
but I love it. Thank you. All right. See, you volunteer to do a radio show, and these are the things that happen. You get T-shirts.
Exactly.
I love it.
Exactly.
Well, thanks so much to all of you guys. The Defners are here. Thanks so much for coming in, and go check them out tomorrow, 1 o'clock at Marine Park, rain or shine, because they'll be in the covered area there. You'll be playing no matter what, and make a contribution to St. Jude's.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks, you guys.
Thank you so much.
Really appreciate coming in. Now, here's Garrison Keillor with Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 17th of July, 2015. It's the birthday of Earl Stanley Gardner, who created the character Perry Mason, the attorney. Earl Stanley Gardner, born in Malden, Massachusetts, 1889. He was a typist at a law firm. He learned legal terminology that way. And though he had no formal training, he passed the California bar exam, and he joined a law firm where he was very bored by legal practice itself, and he started writing crime stories for pulp magazines. His first Perry Mason novel was The Case of the Velvet Claws in 1933, which established Perry Mason's basic MO. He proved his client's innocence by implicating another character who soon confessed. It was on this day 60 years ago, 1955, the Disneyland theme park opened in Anaheim, California, and more than 1 million people came in the first 7 weeks. On this day in 1867, the first college of dentistry opened, Harvard Dental School, establishing dentistry as a branch of medicine. Until then, you learned dentistry by apprenticing yourself to a dentist. Some people still went to a barber or even a blacksmith to have a tooth pulled, and you might replace it with a tooth from a cadaver or dentures made of hard rubber. It's the birthday of the editor Ernest Percival Reese, born in London, 1859, who developed a series of inexpensive works of classic literature, 1,000 titles in all, which he called Everyman's Library. It's the birthday of the Belgian astronomer Georges Lemaître, born in Charleroi, Belgium, 1894. He proposed the Big Bang theory, maintaining that the universe originated with a gigantic explosion of what he called a small superatom, and that the universe is constantly expanding. And it was on this day in 1936 the Spanish Civil War began, the right-wing nationalists trying to overthrow the government. It was the first major threat of fascism in Europe. Here's a poem for today by Patrick Hicks entitled The Strangers. After we picked you up at the Omaha airport, we clamped you into a new car seat and listened to you yowl beneath the streetlights of Nebraska. Our hotel suite was plump with toys, ready, we hoped, to soothe you into America. But for a solid hour, you watched the door, shrieking, Umma, the Korean word for mother. Once or twice, you glanced back at us, and in this nether world, where a door home had slammed shut forever, your terrified eyes paced between the past and the future. Umma, you screamed, Umma. But your foster mother, back in Seoul, never appeared. Your new mother and I lay on the bed, cooing your birth name, until at last you collapsed into our arms. In time, even terror must yield to sleep. A poem by Patrick Hicks, The Strangers, from Adoptable, published by Salmon Poetry and used by permission here on The Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. And by Progressive Insurance, with its Apron Project, celebrating progress and the people who make it happen. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
And welcome back to the KTO Studios with Juno Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein, your host, and I'm here now with the Crimson Quartet, who are going to be playing at Food Truck Fridays in just a matter of hours. You guys need to be rosining up the bow and doing stuff like that, right? So thanks for coming by, and you guys have been together for quite a while. Actually, you're a bunch of young guys, but it seems like you've been playing kind of in and out of this group for this group's been around for a while. Yep. Tell me a little bit about the history of the group.
So we've been around for about 4 to 5 years or so, and we've been kind of rotating through some members, but it's all kind of. We're all kind of still together, and so we have just a lot of fun doing it.
Well, let's go through, and we'll just get. I'll introduce each one of you, and you can just sort of say what instrument you play in the quartet. So you're Henry.
Yeah, I'm Henry, and I'm playing first violin.
And James?
I'm a cellist.
Okay, and Elias?
I'm Elias, I play second violin.
And Noah?
I'm Noah, and I play the viola.
And Noah is the newest member of the band, we've been informed.
Yeah. That's right,
Viola. This was a switch because you were playing viola, but have gone over to first violin.
Yeah.
Now, is this your first performance as first violin for the quartet?
Yes, it will be.
Okay.
So
Noah, we were sort of grilling you a little bit a minute ago because it's your first performance with the quartet. But being first violin, is that kind of the pressure spot?
Somewhat,
like the point guard.
Henry's
you're
carrying
like the
show
guard.
Tonight.
Yeah. Yeah, man. So you're a Stephen Curry out there, right? You're running the show, right? So how does that all work? How do you cue off each other? There's obviously no conductor in a quartet. You're all kind of just working off of each other, your time cues and stuff. Is it the first violin that really dictates that?
Yeah, mostly it's the first violin. But
so how do you do that? How does the first violinist indicate that stuff?
We kind of use like a sniff, if you can. Like,
is that right?
Yeah,
a dramatic sniff.
Uh-huh. A very dramatic sniff.
Really? I love this, like behind the music. I love this. Dramatic sniffs rule it all in quartets. So, you ready to go? And there you go.
Much.
That's
sure.
Pretty much. You guys all just wanted to play right then when I did that, right? You're ready to go. So, tell me a little bit about what drew, I'll pick on you, James, what drew you to kind of classical music and performing as a cellist. Is that just something because you were a kid and like your parents made you do it kind of thing?
Well, schools actually made me do it.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, you know, in sixth grade here, you got to pick an instrument. I picked cello, and I ended up liking it and taking lessons, and it kind of grew from there.
Yeah, that's cool. And you just have really stuck with it. How long have you been playing now?
5-6 years.
Yeah, that's a long kind of time commitment, right, to dedicate to, I mean, right? That's the thing about this stuff. It's a big, like, how many hours a day or how many weeks, how many hours a week or whatever do you feel like you're playing or practicing and doing that kind of stuff?
Well, there's definitely some times in the year when I'm practicing more than others. During the school year, I practice maybe about an hour a day or so. During the summer, I haven't been as diligent, that's for sure. But I still try to
happen. You got to live life, man, right? You got to get out there.
Definitely.
Are you also working a job and like that in the summer? And
yeah, I'm actually working on a whale watching boat, and we're doing a cruise on the 31st of this month. That's a fundraiser for the
Juno String Ensembles.
Oh, okay, very cool. So that's coming up. Is that like an Alamarine boat kind of thing, or which one is it?
It's for Juno Tours. There's the silver boats that say Juno Whale Watch on them.
Yep.
And so it'll be a lot of fun. We're looking forward to doing that. We did that last year, actually, and it was a great time.
Yeah. Now, Noah, how'd you fall in with this crowd? What's the story?
Well, they lost one of their players. He went to college, and he needed a viola player, and I had recently just started playing the viola. I've been playing the violin for 8 or maybe 9 years now, and so I learned the viola.
From a layman's perspective, right, you look at the two instruments, you go, well, that seems like the same instrument, right? So what are some of the differences that you have to really learn?
With a violin and a viola, the music is written in a different clef, so it's written differently, I guess, and the two instruments, the viola is bigger and has a deeper sound than the violin does.
Yeah, so it's just sort of like learning how to get that sound out of it is a little bit different process?
There's different strings that help you get the lowest sound, but you also have to learn to play it differently. The violin is a lighter instrument, while the viola can be much heavier sounding instrument.
And you have to really work the bow a little bit more, that kind of thing. And I'm sure then what instrument do you play? Your cello, your first violin, your...
I also play the violin.
Violin. So there's a first violin and then there's like rhythm section violin. Like you're John Lennon.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
You're John Lennon.
I'll take it.
You're George Harrison. Okay, I got it now. All right. So, do you find playing in a quartet like the funnest thing to play in, or what do you feel like is like the thing that you like the best to play in? If you get to play in full symphonies, is that cool?
Yeah, so playing in a quartet's actually my favorite way to play music, because it's better than just on your own, because you're able to get kind of a harmony in there as well. And I also like it more than playing on a symphony, because it's a lot more intimate. We do practice together quite a bit, and we're really familiar with the way each other play, and so we could kind of balance out the sound pretty well. And so it usually ends up sounding really well.
Cool.
And it's a lot of fun.
How about you?
I enjoy the quartet out of all the other ways of playing with group-wise. You get to add more of your own personal style to it, and it's easier to mix your sounds and get your interpretations into the music.
Yeah, I would think that like playing in a symphony, you kind of could feel like, well, no one really hears. I mean, the point is no one really hears, right? That's the point. You don't want to hear one specific instrument unless you're a kettle drum or something, right?
Yeah.
Kind of up to the conductor then.
Yeah, right. It's up to the conductor as well. So what are you hoping to have happen? I'm looking at new first violin here. What are you hoping to have happen at this performance? You want just, just steady? Keep it going.
No mistake.
No mistake.
Try not to stop.
Try not to stop. That's always good. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
But, if that happens, it's like, oh, well, it's music. It's okay. every now and then, like, that happens on radio where, like, oh, there's dead air. And it's like, it's just dead air for a minute. It's no big deal. That's okay. you don't want it to happen, but if it happens, it's all right. So it's happening. You guys are going on Food Truck Friday. Are you on at 6? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
So you guys are on at 6. There's stuff happening starting at 4. It's a really fun event over there. There's all this great food truck food you go through. There's music and art and all that kind of stuff happening, and it's a really good time. So sounds great, you guys. Congratulations on getting that gig, and good luck to both of you guys, especially on the new roles that you have here in the quartet. Sounds like it's going to be fun. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
All right, go check these guys out, Food Truck Friday. They're going to be playing at 6 o'clock.
Dedicate one to the ladies. Summertime, sip, bang, need something to keep you cool. I know summertime's here, babe. Need something to keep you cool. Better look out now, though. Today's got something for you. Tell you what it is. I'm your ice cream man. Stop me when I'm passing by. Oh, my, my. I'm your ice cream man. Stop me when I'm passing by. See, now all my flavors are guaranteed to satisfy. Hold on a second, baby. I gotta put my banana Dixie cups. All flavors and push-ups too. I'm your ice cream man, baby. Stop me when I'm passing by. See, now all my flavors are guaranteed to satisfy. Hold on one more. Well, I'm usually passing by just about 11 o'clock. I never stop. I'm usually passing by just around 11 o'clock. And if you let me cool you one time, you'll be my regular stop. All right, boys. I'm putting my banana Dixie cups. Oh, flavors and
all right. Continuing on the Food Truck Fridays theme, Joe Orsi's here. Joe, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, appreciate you being here. Orsi's Organic Produce is the, you were saying it's kind of a small business.
Yeah,
you're,
it's like
you're
a
running.
Backyard market garden, and I've got a little bit to sell here today, and kind of a family type operation.
Very
we got
cool.
The full gamut of things from zucchini, shallots, kale. Let's see what else. Cucumbers. I put in a big high tunnel last fall, so I got a lot of new stuff.
Tell me what goes into, and Mark Wheeler's here
English,
as well.
Yeah, and slicing.
Mark from Copa is here as well. Mark, thanks for coming in.
Hey, I just butted in.
That's fine. We'll be talking to you as well in a moment. Are you representative Food Truck Fridays as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, we'll be there. We're going to be there selling ice cream.
And then also, of course, we've got National Ice Cream Day coming up, which we'll talk about that in a moment. But, Joe, tell me a little bit about the process of making sure things are organic. You know, so how do you sort of make sure that every step of the way you're staying to that sort of code?
There's some standards that you go by. Basically, you're not using any chemical pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, and all your fertilizers have an organic base. There's different certification. I'm not, you know, officially organically certified, but as long as I sell less than $5,000 worth of produce, I can still claim to be organic as long as I abide by the organic practices.
Mm-hmm. Is it harder?
Yes, it's more expensive, harder, and it takes a while to build your soil up because, you know, organic soil is a lot not as fertile as chemical-induced
sure.
soils,
yeah.
but it's a lot more sustainable, and as long as you do crop rotations and pay attention to soil conservation, it's actually a better way to go.
Yeah, it seems like it's sort of a real discipline that you have to kind of learn a little bit and, you know, really do some homework about it.
It took me 30 years.
That's what I was going to ask next, yeah. So when you started kind of gardening 30 years ago, were you doing organic work as well, or did you kind of work into it?
I kind of worked into it. You know, in Southeast, I've been 30. I grew up in Southern California, and I gardened a little bit in our backyard there, you know, where you can grow corn, watermelons, cantaloupes, and things like that, but moving up to South
tomatoes. Oh,
yeah,
tomatoes.
Oh. I do have some tomatoes in a high tunnel, but they're still green and small. I'm kind of learning because there's a lot of things that go along with a high tunnel that require, you know, the drip irrigation and fertigation and things like that. You have to kind of learn that process and the timetables and whatnot. But
can you define what that high tunnel? What is
high
that?
Tunnel is it's a framework that goes over existing cropland. And I guess it differs than a greenhouse that it's semi-permanent. In other words, you can move it around from one area to the next. And there's no it's just kind of it's built over existing cropland as opposed to, you know, a greenhouse is just put somewhere and you have pots and, you know, heat in a lot of cases and lights. But a high tunnel is just basically over, you know, existing croplands. You see them a lot in the Midwest, and they're doing a lot up in South Central, like Homer and Kenai, a lot of big high tunnels up there. And there's a grant that I got for subsidizing half of the cost of it through the USDA. So that was an incentive for me to take the leap last fall.
So what are some of the big, like, what's the hardest thing about gardening in Southeast Alaska? I mean, is it just the...
Take a look out the window. You're looking at it.
It's the rain.
Everything's wet. Yeah.
Yeah. Which, of course, often, you know, is sort of a little bit counterintuitive. Of course, you want rain for...
to some extent, yeah.
You know, but so what do you do to mitigate that?
Okay, what you want to do is you want to elevate your soil and you want to dry it out and add organic material so it retains the little moisture that you give it. And then also I use a plastic film over my rows, What that does is it allows the infrared rays to pass through. It's spelled special IRT plastic, and it blocks off the photosynthetic rays. So you get the warming effect of the sun, but you don't get the weed growth underneath. When the weeds are the killer in this country to try to keep up with things. So you use the plastic film, and then around the edges of my garden perimeter, I use a Permatex. It's like a woven black mat, stuff mm-hmm. you get like 10-foot rows. And I border everything with that so the weeds can't take a stronghold and work their way into the main garden beds.
Is there something you're proudest of growing? I mean, maybe that's...
This year, cucumbers. I mean, I've done really good, and I have a lot for sale, actually, today. So,
what about that? There you go.
The English slicers, the regular slicers, and even some picklers. So that was...
Are they hard?
Can I buy all your pickles right now?
I've only got about 20 or 30, I think. So I have to go quick.
Pre-buy? Can we pre-buy it?
Put in a pre-order. Well, Mark, tell me a little bit of what's happening with food. Let's talk Food Truck Friday first. What are you guys serving over there today?
Well, we have ice cream.
Yes, delicious.
And, we were doing...
I'm a fan.
On the sunny days, we were doing some ice cream sandwiches with some... fried croissant dough. I was calling it fried Alaska. But it's raining and we're going to be inside, so I'm not going to be able to do the deep fryer. I brought a little Fry Daddy out. Was making these croissants, like a cronut. You take the croissant dough and deep fry it.
Right.
Slice it open, put some ice cream in the middle.
Sounds amazing.
Good.
Yeah.
Seriously,
sounds
good.
Amazing.
I brought you some today. You guys want to try this? This is it's been a great year for cherries in the flats.
Your
neighborhood, Andy.
My gosh, I got
cherries right over the top.
Ron Crenshaw's cherry tree is over the fence and half in my yard, and I'm going for it. I'm not telling him either, man. I'm just picking away.
So this is flat
Ron,
cherries.
If you're listening, I've been taking all your cherries.
Flats cherries and bourbon from Haynes.
Ooh.
The Port Chilkoot Distillery bourbon.
That is delicious.
That's very nice.
Do you soak the cherries in the bourbon? Is that what you do? Or
I cook them. I cook the cherries and some sugar, cook them way down. And then throw some bourbon at the end. And that bourbon kind of flashes off, but you still get the taste.
That's delicious.
And I guess I got to grab that back with me. But it's we like to do local ingredients, and we love to source some stuff from Joe, too. But so cherries, rhubarb is our big thing. We're doing spruce dip ice cream this year. We did a Devil's Club in the spring using the buds, and that was really
Boy, tasty. Is that fantastic. You know, the cherries kind of have a honey characteristic to them because of that way you've cooked it down. Or is there honey in there as well?
No, but I think bourbon and fruit.
Yeah.
Bourbon and stone fruit.
Yeah,
like
right.
I did a Aprium bourbon the other day with Apriums from Costco, which is an apricot plum cross.
Okay.
And it was really good.
Wow.
But this, my chef Isaac made the base, and he was going to do something else with it. And I hijacked his ice cream this morning, and I took it. So we collaborate in the kitchen. But
you steal.
I steal.
collaborate. You borrow. Collaborate.
How about raspberries, Mark? You do a lot of raspberries.
Well, there's not too many raspberries. I love to have raspberries,
We've got some fresh stuff that we're going to be selling, some fresh raspberries in the clamshells there. And then we make a raspberry jam from most of the raspberries because they're hard to – it's hard to get fresh raspberries because of the timing and just the quality. You know, they got to be just right.
So different than the wild raspberries we see around here, right? These are
we don't have wild raspberries.
We have salmon berries, but they're kind of. I mean, like we've got some growing around in the flats.
Yeah, those are domesticated.
There's some volunteers domesticated.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wild raspberries are up north, but we don't have
that
here.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So, so you're cultivating those domestic raspberry bushes and
we probably sell every year about 130 half pints.
Wow. How much land do you have that you're operating on?
We have a little over an acre, but what's cultivated is probably, I've got, 1,200 square feet under the high tunnel and another couple thousand on just kind of open field rows.
And where is it around?
Out at 16 Mile. It's past Ockrek on the uphill side, kind of, southwest facing slope.
Yeah, so that's the sunny part of town out that way. Yeah,
a little bit drier than
town. That's right, yeah.
The Clinkett knew where to build a town.
That's right.
Man, they knew where to put a town. And we just have to follow the gold.
Right. What are we doing here?
100-mile-an-hour winds in the wintertime.
So now let's talk about the exciting thing that's happening. Is this tomorrow?
Sunday. The third Sunday in July, Ronald Reagan decreed as National Ice Cream Day. So we're going to celebrate that.
And I knew there was something I liked him for,
In a grand opening. We're having a grand opening of our ice cream cart on Sunday. So we're going to do both, celebrate ice cream celebrating our ice cream cart and these Alaskan ice cream flavors we're making and selling to our wonderful visitors.
Where are you going to be?
So our cart is on South Franklin at Ferry Way, right across from the Alaskan Brewing Depot.
Yep.
And so we're going to be 11 to 7 on Sunday, and from 2 to 5 we're going to have some live music. Ian Leonard's going to play at 2, and If the Ocean's going to play at 3. And I have an act right on the hook for 4.
Okay.
So it's going to be fun. We're going to have a party, and we're going to give away a free kid scoop with every purchase. And just come on down and enjoy ice cream. You know, Ronald Reagan did this, but presidents for a long time have enjoyed ice cream. And
is there a history of presidents enjoying ice cream?
Yeah, even going back to George Washington.
Really?
You know, this is an American dessert. You talk about apple pie, ice cream is America.
Is it? Was it really formed in America? I always think Italian gelato and stuff like that.
It goes back to the Roman emperors. They first made ice cream taking snow from the Alps with their slaves and then bringing it down and coloring that with fruit and other things. The Chinese made it, too. I guess Marco Polo brought it back from China. But, it started in Europe, and we brought it over. But we eat more ice cream than anybody in America.
Yeah.
America. And it's a great thing. I mean, we did a ice cream social up at the governor's house, and he did it to try to, build some bridges with the legislature, because ice cream makes friends.
Everyone gets it.
We liked it.
Yeah.
It's a great uniter.
Get in an argument about ice cream? No way.
No.
That's right. Well, what are some of the fun, this is an amazing flavor. What are some of the other fun ones you're experimenting with right now that maybe people will get to on Sunday especially, or tonight?
Yes, we're going to have that. We're going to have our spruce dip, our rhubarb sherbet.
That's really good, rhubarb sherbet.
Nice. That's our most popular flavor.
Yeah, that's nice.
And we have a killer vanilla. I got to be honest. There are vanilla. We use beans from Madagascar, and we're just sourcing now some extract from Madagascar vanilla beans, and it's something else.
Wow.
I'm proud of the vanilla. But Isaac, again, he really mastered chocolate, too, so we have a really good Belgian chocolate ice cream. And then we do other fun stuff, like I've been playing around with smoked alder. We made a smoked alder with birch syrup.
Nice.
I'm not going to have that on Sunday, but that's been a fun one. And what are some? We do a lot of beer ice creams. We're going to do. We have some oatmeal stout ice creams we're going to have out on Sunday.
I love the stouts
and the porters really make good ice cream.
Oh, yeah. That Graham Porter ice cream you made that one time was outstanding.
Yeah. So beer and ice beer. There's different chemical reactions in ice cream ingredients, and with alcohol, like the bourbon and beer, those lower the freezing point of the structure, so it gets a more creamy texture.
Mm-hmm.
Sugar does the same thing, salt does the same thing, and it's really interesting. It's a very complex kind of chemical, physical composition of ice cream, but all these things kind of interact and contribute to the mouthfeel and the presentation. But the beer is fun to play with.
All right. So you got lots of turning over to you, Joe, again.
Okay.
Lots of stuff for sale right now, Food Truck Fridays.
Yeah.
Is there stuff that people should be looking for that might be at its peak right now?
Yeah, I'd say the cucumbers and zucchinis, shallots, and have some kale and carrots and raspberry jam, fresh raspberries. And what else is – I think that might be about it.
Okay.
A lot of potatoes, too. Got new potatoes. In other words, pull them out a little early just to get people some fresh product.
Right.
So the skins are very thin, but it's been a good year, so decided to harvest a fair amount. So there'll be a lot of multicolored potatoes, different varieties that work good
all right.
in the past.
Well, it's all happening. Food Truck Friday starting right now, really. 4 o'clock is when it's starting, so I got to let you get over there.
Let's go.
Okay,
come
you on. Guys got to get going, and that's it for Juno Afternoon.
Andy. Thanks so much for both of you
for coming in. And I want to thank everyone who appeared on Juno Afternoon today. Lots of folks, including Katie Bosler and Laura Steele from UAS. We had the Vermont Junior Cornhole Team. You can join them tomorrow at 1 p.m. at Marine Park and help contribute to St. Jude's Hospital. Also, go check out Food Truck Friday. Lots of stuff going on over there, including the Crimson Quartet. Thanks to those guys for coming in. And Joe Orsi's over there selling delicious organic fruit and vegetables. Of course, Copa's over there as well. And thanks to Mark Wheeler for coming in from Copa to talk about that. And also National Ice Cream Day happening Sunday. We can all get behind that, right? And Josh Warren and Andy Hirsch from the library talking about next Saturday's game day at the library. Go check it out. Don't get bored. Play a board game. All right. Thanks so much for listening, everyone. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today. All Things Considered is next.
Secretary of Defense Ash Carter heads to the Middle East, where he'll face questions about the nuclear deal with Iran.
Carter's first stop is where the reaction has been most negative, Israel.
It's Friday, July 17th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Also in this hour, our Friday political commentators on the Iran deal.
Our reporter takes a journey home to the Wisconsin town where Scott Walker caught the political bug.
His high school yearbook shows young Walker was a big joiner.
Foreign language club.